to work. You need a vacation line on your budget, and that line needs to get $500 of your money every month between now and then. That means you can't buy $2,000 worth of plane tickets for at least 4 months. So this can impact when you take your trip if you have to book everything in advance. When I explain this to some people, I can see their hearts sink right in front of me. The dream of an exotic family trip can be so enticing, but when they see the $500 monthly price tag the dream requires, they realize it honestly doesn't make sense in their financial situation. For now, at least. I hate that for them, but what I'd hate even more is for them to take a trip anyway and bring home a mountain of credit card debt that would take years to pay off. Don't ruin such a special trip by setting yourself up to hate the memory of it 3 years from now. Save like you mean it, remember? That includes vacations. Until you have the cash available, consider taking a big trip every few years with smaller trips in between. Once you're on the trip, whether it's a big, once-in-a-lifetime excursion or just a weekend trip to the beach, the worst thing you can do is say, "We're on vacation. Let's just spend money and enjoy. We'll worry about the costs later." I have been known to say this a time or two. The hard reality is that all those debit card charges still count even when you're out of town. You might enjoy it for the moment, but a week later, reality will come crashing in on you. Don't put a dark cloud of regret over a vacation with your family. You want your smile to be just as big after the trip as it is in all the vacation pictures. Remember, the money you saved for the trip should be guilt-free spending, so enjoy it. I know this is a drum I can't stop beating, but when it comes to vacations, remember not to compare your trip or your lack of trips to everyone around you. Don't let the photo of your friend's feet in the sand with the ocean in the background steal the joy of your long weekend getaway to a cabin in the woods. And don't let your neighbor's vacation pictures be the motivation for your trip. This is an easy place to compare because our social media feeds are full of vacation photos. Charge it to cash, not the room. One thing that's even easier than swiping a card is saying the dangerous little phrase, "Oh, just charge it to the room." Those magic words remove every bit of friction from making a purchase. You can spend money without even thinking about it. It's the verbal equivalent of Amazon's one-click purchasing button. Most hotels and resorts make it easy for you to spend money on their property. If your local grocery store tried to charge the hotel and resort prices for food and drinks, you'd laugh and move along. But if a resort offers the service of delivering these items to your room, you would not only pay the crazy prices, but you would tip and thank whoever brings those things to you. Cut your costs. If you're looking for one big way to cut costs on a family vacation, here it is. Make your own meals. But Rachel, eating out is part of what makes vacation so special. I know. If you've got plenty of budgeted money to spend and eating out is a priority for you, go for it. However, if the destination is a higher priority than the meals, try eating most of your meals in the room. Vacation planners will tell you to spend $50 to $100 a day per person on food. Taking a trip to the grocery store instead of the steakhouse once you get to your destination can save you hundreds on the trip. Winston's family has a tradition of going to the beach each year around spring break. His parents rent a big house and we all get together for a week. We eat most of our meals in the home and each couple prepares one dinner during the week. We eat in 4 nights and then we go out the other 2 nights. That routine works really well for us, especially since there's little kids running around. Sometimes it's more relaxing for parents if the kids can run wild at a home or hotel instead of at a restaurant. Extended family vacations. Now that many of my friends are married with little kids, I'm starting to notice a trend when it comes to vacations. We're seeing these huge family trips where an older couple invites their adult children and grandkids on one big family getaway. My own family does this, and I love getting away with my parents, my sister's family, and my brother. We love spending time together, and we love to travel. These vacations mean the world to me. These trips can also be tricky, though, when it's unclear who's paying for what. In some families, the grandparents will pay the whole bill for everyone to go. In others, the grandparents make the plans but expect their adult children to pay their own way. Either way is fine, as long as everyone is on board with the decision. Too often, though, someone in the family makes crazy plans and simply expects everyone else to fall in line. The problem is, everyone may be at different places financially. A $1,000 getaway next month may not be a big deal for you, but it could be devastating to your brother's family. When planning big family trips, everyone has to be upfront and honest about what they can do, and everyone else needs to respect those decisions. If your parents want to take your family on a great trip and pay for everything, take off and have fun. But if they expect you to pay your own way on a trip you didn't plan, or maybe even didn't want to go on, it's time to talk with mom and dad. You remember we said that your kids don't get to decide how you spend your money, right? Well, the same is true for your parents. If you don't have the money to take the trip, or if you have other priorities for your money, then the answer should be a graceful no. There's no shame or guilt in that. Do what's best for your own family, even if it means disappointing your parents. If you do decide to go, set reasonable expectations on the front end and be sure that everyone is on the same page. Eliminate surprises where you can. Are you expected to pay for your amusement park tickets, airfare, hotel room, or part of the house that was rented? Are you expected to pay for your own meals? If so, how many? All of them? Are you expected to pay for your own travel? Nothing ruins a family trip like getting to a restaurant and not knowing who's going to pick up the tab. If you're at the end of the vacation and it's time to pay the bill, not having had this conversation in advance will create an awkward situation. If no one steps up to pay, you may feel like you need to cover the bill because talking about it would be too weird. Now you're paying for something you weren't expecting to, and it can put a dark cloud over the vacation and the relationships with family members. Talk about all of this stuff beforehand. It's not rude or disrespectful to your parents or siblings to ask for an open and honest conversation. Everyone else is probably hoping someone will step up with the courage to raise the subject. Your boldness could save not only you, but also your other family members from a financial and emotional mess. Where things get tricky is if you're expected to pay for some things, but you don't have the money, or you're choosing to put all your extra money towards paying off debt. As uncomfortable as it might be, you need to share that with whoever is planning or coordinating the trip. The honesty might seem harsh, and your parents might not be happy, but you need to do what's best for you. That doesn't mean you're saying no to family trips for the rest of your life. It's just for a short period of time. There will be other trips, but this one may not be the best use of your money right now. Stay away. Another vacation trap you want to avoid are some of the deals you encounter. Many of these can be found online. Some of these deals are legit and great. Others are ripoffs and are too good to be true. I once saw a TV commercial for a travel website that set this up perfectly. A gentleman books a vacation from the website, and the place looks gorgeous. Beautiful pictures of white sands, open beaches, and crystal clear blue water beckon him as he books his trip. Then the camera pans to him arriving at the destination. There's trash and broken glass everywhere, barely any place to walk, and he can see a few dorsal fins in the distance. Don't be like that guy. Look around, do your research, and know what you're getting yourself into. Next, avoid timeshares altogether. They're the easiest contracts to walk into, but some of the hardest to get out of. The only way to get out of a timeshare deal is to sell it. But that'll be next to impossible because no one wants it. Don't even go to the presentation. I promise. The free breakfast they give you won't be worth the relentless sales pressure and emotional wringer they'll put you through. A timeshare just gives you an expensive piece of real estate that you can't sell and that you can only enjoy one or a few weeks out of the year. It also locks you into the same vacation spot year after year for decades because you'll feel pressure to go back every year since you're still paying for it. Keep your options open. If you want to hit the same beach every year, then do it, but at least give yourself the freedom to pick new and exciting places to stay. Be cheap, or don't. Many cities have free attractions for families. They can help you save money and add variety to a trip if needed. Look around and ask locals for suggestions. There are a lot of memory-making fun things to do for free if you're creative and do your research. But if you've saved up for this vacation and you have the money set aside to spend, then spend it. Enjoy your hard work and patience by allowing yourself to buy something you want. You will find the more you save up and have to spend on the trip, the more enjoyable it seems. Sometimes it's worth putting the trip off a few months to get some extra cash in the bank so you can enjoy some luxury while relaxing on a fun vacation. Take control of your spending. Food, clothing, homes, birthdays, holidays, vacations. All of these things demand spending decisions that reflect what's truly important to us. However, there is nothing worse than working long, hard hours for your money and then wondering where it all went. That will leave you feeling broke and broken. But even if that's where you've been up to this point, I have good news. Your past doesn't have to dictate your future. You can make decisions and create new habits today that will change the course of your future. There is hope, but it begins with focusing your attention now and taking control of your spending. Remember, think before you spend. Habit 7. Give a little until you can give a lot. Chapter 14. A lifestyle of giving. One of our best friends is a pretty incredible guy. He has dedicated his life to helping young men in the inner city who don't have a father figure in their lives. Our friend has stepped into this community and people have fallen in love with him and his heart. He has built relationships with these teenage guys and has helped them walk through some pretty tough situations. He does everything from taking them to school to picking them up from football practice to buying them groceries if food is low in their home. He'll do just about anything for them. The impact he's made in the lives of these young men and their families is pretty remarkable. He's become exactly what they need most, a stable friend and mentor in the middle of their hectic world. When I think about giving, I think about this guy. And it's not just the giving he's doing with his own life that's inspiring, but it's also the way others in our community have come around him to support him financially. We all feel a connection to him and his incredible ministry, and we want to join together to contribute to the work he's doing. Generosity isn't a simple act of giving or grand event. Generosity is a lifestyle that changes hearts and minds as it blesses everyone involved. I have learned over the years that giving is the most fun you can have with money. And I have to say, I'm hooked. Outrageously generous. The habit of giving is the exclamation mark when it comes to our money. Improving your bank account isn't the primary purpose of good money habits. While that's important, it isn't where your journey with money should end. As you bring your money into alignment with your values, you begin to see what you have to give. Your time, money, and abilities can become instruments of grace that can impact the trajectory of others' lives forever. Having good money habits in place will help you find peace of mind. You will get to live a life on your terms instead of the bank's. You'll build wealth and buy the things that are important to you. You'll get out of debt once and for all. You'll communicate with your spouse, kids, and others at a deeper level. But as wonderful as those things are, they aren't the end goal. Ultimately, you want to win with money so you can become an outrageous giver. Giving can be a difficult topic for people to understand because they don't know why or how they should give. But once you've answered those questions for yourself, there will be no turning back. Why should I give? Something happens in your heart when you give, something that changes you for the better. It's easy, even natural, to live in a selfish state of mind. Our entire culture is based on an attitude that demands me first and instant gratification. And our lives are often centered around what makes us happy. What do I want? How do I look? Where should we go? It's tempting to spend most of our energy each day answering these questions for ourselves. And if giving isn't already a lifestyle for you, becoming a generous person can seem counterintuitive. It can feel like an uphill battle at first. But as you begin to shift your focus from fulfilling your own needs and wishes to meeting the needs of others, you change. You learn what it means to be truly happy. It really is true that generous people are not only the happiest people on the planet, but they also truly live more fulfilling lives. Selling the American Dream. One powerful story of generosity is captured in the book The Power of Half by Hannah and Kevin Selwyn. It's a story about an average American family who worked hard and achieved much. At the beginning of the book, they have everything most people strive for their whole lives to obtain. They drive new cars, live in a big house, and have lots of nice stuff. Then Hannah Selwyn, only 14 years old at the time, becomes restless about the homeless people in her city. Her parents encourage her desire to help, but nothing dramatically changes in the family's lifestyle. Over the course of months and years, her passion to help others moves her parents so much that they decide to sell their home and give half the proceeds to charity. The sum total they gave away was about $800,000. This family's journey has taught me that every person has a choice to make with what they've been given. It doesn't matter if you have a lot or a little. Generosity is something everyone can practice. Now, don't freak out. I'm not saying that once you start practicing generosity, that you'll end up selling your house and giving away half the money. That's a pretty unique call on one family's life. However, and this is the thing that might really surprise you, you might find that you want to start doing stuff like that. It may start small, like maybe a $50 tip on a $10 restaurant bill to help a struggling server who's working on Thanksgiving Day. But the impact of even small acts of generosity can have a powerful, far-reaching ripple effect. It changes everyone involved, starting with you. People who love their money and stuff more than they love other people will live small, lonely, and ultimately ineffective lives. There is room for you to build wealth and enjoy the things money can buy. We've talked about that throughout the book, and it's what I want for you. But the end game of practicing good money habits is not to buy so much stuff for ourselves that it fills up our garages and rented storage units. The real goal of building wealth is to leave a measurable and meaningful mark on the people around you. I believe that our culture is struggling with the disease of selfishness and discontentment, and generosity is the only cure I know. What the Bible says about giving. Another reason I give is because giving is a foundational part of my Christian faith. I understand that you may not share my beliefs, but it is hard to dismiss the wisdom in the Bible's financial teaching. Throughout the scriptures, you can find clear teaching on budgeting, debt, saving, spending, comparison living, everything that we've covered in this book so far. And, of course, the Bible also has a lot to say about giving. Jesus talked more about money in the New Testament than anything else, including heaven and hell. Why is that? Because money is never just about money. What you and I do with our money is evidence of what we believe. Whether it's giving to your local church or directly to help others in need, the act of giving is something beautiful. Giving changes us, both in the giving and the receiving. The first thing that changes, I think, is our perspective of ownership. The Bible says, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." Psalm 24:1. He owns the whole world and everything in it, including my stuff. If He is the owner, then I am just the manager. He lets me use and enjoy a portion of His wealth, but I never lose sight of the fact that it's not really mine. Giving money away is simply a reminder of my position and my role in the world. Scripture says we were all made in the image of God. If God is the biggest giver of all, then I am, by design, supposed to be a giver too. Generosity is a part of my spiritual DNA. Two people immediately come to mind for me when I think about the power of giving. They are a married couple who are now in their 80s. He is a retired surgeon. She was a stay-at-home mom. They decided early in their marriage to live on no more than 10% of their earnings. Granted, they were living in a multi-million dollar home and enjoying all the trappings of a well-funded life. But all of this came out of only 10% of their income. They made it a personal mission to alter their lifestyle so they can use what God had given them to help others. This couple would never want you to think of them as heroic or inspirational, but simply as living from a place of personal faith. We've been talking a lot in this book about setting your finances up in such a way that you can spend money on things you value. Well, this couple valued giving, and they set their lifestyle around that conviction. I'm not suggesting that you live on 10% of your income, unless God puts that specific call in your heart. But what I hope you can take away from the story is that this couple was open to giving whatever they felt called to give. They live with an open hand, and in doing so, they are an encouragement and a blessing to those around them. Throughout their entire adult lives, they made giving a priority and centered their finances on that one thing because that's what they valued. Giving and your financial plan. Whenever I talk about giving, someone usually comes up to me and says something like, "Rachel, that all sounds amazing. I'd love to be able to give to people in need and to causes I believe in. When do you think I'll have enough money to be able to give generously?" If that's you, I've got good news for you. You can start today. That's right. I believe giving should always be a part of your financial plan, no matter how much or how little you have. Even if you think you can't afford it, I encourage you to work some giving into your budget. This is a critical money habit you need to develop if you want to win with money. I believe this habit is just as important as the others we've discussed, including saving, budgeting, and staying out of debt. If you do all those things but leave giving out of your plan, your life will always be out of balance. Getting started. Every day is an opportunity to start becoming a more generous person. You always need to be giving no matter where you are financially. If you're getting out of debt or saving up for that emergency fund, then try giving a little right now. If you are debt-free with a full emergency fund and retirement savings underway, then you could find some bigger opportunities to make a difference. I teach people to give off the top of what they make. That means giving should be the first line in your budget unless you honestly don't have enough money to cover your basic necessities. If you put giving, or saving for that matter, at the bottom of the list, you'll never get to it. Something else will always seem more important, so make giving a priority. If you've never given regularly before, I suggest starting with 10% of your income each month. If that sounds intimidating, start smaller while you get used to it and then increase over time. The amount doesn't even matter when you're just getting started. The point is to start with something and make it a regular part of your lifestyle. The goal is to make this a habit, and that means you've got to find ways to give often. Over time, the habit starts to take hold, and giving will not only feel perfectly natural, but you'll also feel like something important is missing if you go too long without doing it. Giving even when it's tight. You may be in a tight place with your money, but don't let that stop you from experiencing the joy of giving. That said, make sure you can cover your rent or mortgage, your transportation, clothes to wear, and food to eat. Go back to the budget and make sure you're covering your basic needs. I'm not a fan of the give until it hurts philosophy. I'm more of a God loves a cheerful giver kind of person. 2 Corinthians 9:7. It's hard to give cheerfully if doing so means your kids won't have dinner this week. So, while I want you to develop a habit of generous giving, I don't want you to put your family in danger. Make sure your basic needs are covered and then start giving. With your basic needs taken care of, you should have some room to give. Making giving a priority, though, may mean making some difficult judgment calls on some of the wants in your life. It may mean some stuff has to go. If you have to take your 2,000 cable channels down to 500 in order to free up some cash to give, the exchange will be worth it. You will get more out of life helping that single mom out with Christmas than with the 1,500 cable channels you are missing. Even then, those 1,500 cable channels are not gone for good. Once you get better control of your money and are in a position to get those channels back, then do it. If you find yourself in a position where you can't afford to give even a small amount of money, then set a date for when you want to start giving. Don't throw it too far in the future, however. I'm talking about sometime in the next 30 to 60 days. That should be plenty of time to make some changes and free up some cash to give. If you make a plan for your money with a budget and stick to that budget, you should be able to find a way to start giving regularly in short order. Start where you are, and then you can grow your level of giving over time. Give even while getting out of debt. People often ask if they should give while they're working to pay off their debt. While you want to get out of debt as fast as you can, giving should be a part of your plan as you work the debt snowball. All of the habits we've talked about work together to help you win with money overall. Developing these habits is not just about changing your attitude about debt, saving, and spending, but changing your whole relationship with money. Giving at every step in the process does that more effectively than anything else. As you stay focused over time, you'll find that you can give while paying off your student loans, car payments, credit cards, and mortgage. This is exactly what my parents did as they climbed out of the black hole of bankruptcy. My earliest memory of giving took place in church. Every week, I sat in my seat on the pew and watched my parents as the offering bag came by. Even as a young child, I understood that money was tight. I knew Dad was working all day and night to get the family back on our feet. Every dollar mattered, not only to us, but also to the company he had just started to build. Even though the stakes were high, Mom and Dad put a folded check in the red velvet offering bag every week, without fail. For them, giving was a non-negotiable. Flexing your giving muscles. I've learned that what you do when times are hard is a good indication of what you'll do when times are going well. Whatever was written on those checks my parents gave doesn't compare to their capacity to give now. But if they hadn't committed to a habit of giving and generosity then, I doubt they'd be as generous as they are today. John D. Rockefeller, generally regarded as the wealthiest man in U.S. history, may have said it best. I never would have been able to tithe the first $1 million I ever made if I had not tithed my first salary, which was $1.50 per week. That was a long time ago, but if you can only afford to give $1.50 a week right now, then start there. Like I said before, the dollar amount isn't the issue. The real issue is the habit you're building, the attitude you're developing about giving in general. That's why I call this habit, give a little until you can give a lot. You see, I know that if you will start flexing those giving muscles, even when you don't have much to give, you'll not only set yourself up to be able to give a lot in the future, but you'll also set yourself up to actually want to. Toward a life of giving. A friend recently told me about something her 5-year-old daughter had become passionate about. The little girl had learned in Sunday school about a local family who was trying to raise enough money for their child to get an important medical procedure. The teacher encouraged all the kids to collect pennies, nickels, and dimes during the week and bring them to church the next Sunday. Then they would collect all the money from all the classes and send that money to an organization that would help fund the medical procedure. This little girl wasn't satisfied with the amount of pennies, nickels, and dimes she found around the house. She asked her parents to help, then her grandparents, and then just about anyone she came in contact with that week. On Saturday night, my friend sat down with her daughter to count all the money she had collected. My friend said, "Honey, you did great. I'm so proud of you. I'm sure that little girl will be happy you helped her get the help she needed." Her daughter responded, "Mommy, that's not enough." She thought for a moment and then left the table. She came back a few minutes later with a handful of crumbled up bills in her hand, another $12 from the jar she was using to save up for a new doll. My friend teared up at this point, and she asked her, "Are you sure you want to give away all the money you've been saving? You don't have to do that." The little girl said, "Yes, I want to." In total, my friend's daughter took more than $100 to church with her on Sunday. At 5 years old, she had learned that it's not enough to simply ask other people to give. She wanted to participate in the giving herself. A life of giving was the life she wanted. That's exactly what I want for you. A great start. It doesn't matter where you are, how old you are, or how much you have. It doesn't matter if you have a little to give or a lot to give. What matters is the decision to make giving a key habit in your life. When you do that, you unlock the power to totally change your relationship with money. You'll be set up to win and give like you never thought possible. And I promise it'll be an amazing journey. Chapter 15, How to Give. It was one of those days for the both of us. When Winston and I got home after work, we both just knew the other had had a similar day. Nothing out of the ordinary or really bad, just a long, exhausting day. We were too tired to cook, so we decided to go out for dinner. We didn't go to a fancy, expensive place, just a local restaurant we knew we could count on for good food, friendly service, and a relaxing atmosphere. As we walked into the restaurant, we saw an older couple that I had known most of my life. We caught up briefly and then followed the hostess to our table. We ordered our favorite meals and sat talking to each other. It was fun to laugh at the stuff that had happened during the day and enjoy some downtime together. As dinner was ending, we asked the server for the bill. He said, "It's been taken care of. The couple who was seated over there paid for your meal." We were both shocked and grateful at the same time, and just blown away that they would think to do that. That single act of kindness changed our whole attitude about the day. We went to bed that night smiling and feeling grateful, which was definitely not the attitudes we had when we first got home from work. Someone cared enough to step into our lives just for a second, and it made an impact that we're still talking about years later. Back to the basics. Often we think about giving in huge, world-changing terms. We think about giving a significant contribution to a missionary or helping an organization dig wells in Africa. Those are great causes, but if that's all we think of, we have a limited view of giving. The small, spur-of-the-moment acts of kindness make a difference, too, and can completely turn someone's life around. And it's just so much fun to give to others, especially when they're not expecting it. As we thought more about that simple act of kindness in the restaurant, Winston and I expanded our view of giving. We started looking for little ways we could impact other people's lives every day. But generous giving can get complicated. There are a lot of ways you can give, from individuals in need to seemingly endless nonprofits doing good things to an infinite number of add-on gifts that you can make while checking out at the grocery store. How do you know what's the right time to give, who you should give to, and how you can be generous without breaking the bank? Let's talk about it. Percentage giving. As a Christian, I believe giving begins with the local church. Winston and I give 10% of our income to our church as a starting point. That percentage is what's written at the top of our budget. We always put giving first to keep money in the proper perspective. Where you give is totally up to you and your family, making sure that your giving follows your personal values. We follow what Scripture says and give 10% or a tithe to the local church to support their ministry and mission. When we give above and beyond that 10% baseline, we direct that money to other causes that Winston and I believe in. It's hard to start your giving at 10% if you're not used to giving at all. A pastor once challenged his congregation to increase their giving 1% over the previous year. His goal was to get everyone to participate in the giving process. He knew that going from 0 to 10% was going to be too steep of a climb for some. By suggesting everyone give just 1% more, giving became manageable for everyone in the congregation. He gave them a practical, unintimidating place to start. If you stretch slowly from where you are, you'll be amazed just how generous you can become. Again, 10% shouldn't be the final goal, but only the beginning. Consider the surgeon and his wife we talked about in the previous chapter. What if you set a lifetime goal to increase your giving even by only 1% every year of your working lifetime? You probably wouldn't even notice the missing 1% year to year, but think about the impact you could have and the legacy you could build. The cool thing about percentage giving is that it grows right along with your income. As you earn more, you give more. It's automatic. You don't have to think about it. Plus, if you're used to living on 90% of your income every month, and then you get a raise, you still get to feel the impact of that raise. After the pay increase, you'll give more and you'll bring more money home every month. It's not like you're giving up your Christmas bonus every year. Don't let fear or intimidation keep you from building the habit of giving. Start where you are, and like we discussed in the last chapter, begin flexing those giving muscles with whatever feels comfortable right now. The easy button. Winston and I set up auto drafts for the gifts we make on a recurring basis, such as our tithe to our church. I travel a lot, and our schedules are crazy at times. Putting our reoccurring giving on autopilot ensures that we are giving regularly, even if we're out of town most of the month. The only problem with this is that I sometimes don't feel like I'm giving at all. It can easily become out of sight, out of mind. Because it's so automated, I don't always feel like I'm giving up something or even emotionally connected to the money I'm giving away. That's why it's important for us to give in other ways as well. Sometimes it's good to feel the struggle. That mild discomfort is a constant reminder that the money is not mine to begin with. All of it belongs to God, and He has given it to me to manage. Now let's talk about how people with variable incomes, those who don't make the same amount every month, should give. If you fall into this category, you might feel like you can't put your giving on autopilot because you don't know how much you'll make in a month. Winston and I both have variable incomes, so we do our best to estimate our income at the beginning of each month. That's what we base our monthly auto withdrawal amount on. Then we check our giving in relation to our income throughout the year and at the end of the year. If we underestimated our income, we simply write a check for the difference. If you're just starting out, give with cash or a check. There is something powerful about the physical experience of giving money away. Auto-drafting your giving is convenient, but it can be easy to forget about since you don't have to take any action to make it happen. As giving becomes more and more of a habit, and as you grow to enjoy the experience of giving, then start exploring automatic systems to make things easier. Tax deductible. A side benefit of giving is that any money you give to a legally designated nonprofit or religious organization is tax deductible. That shouldn't be the reason for giving, but if you're giving anyway, you should take advantage of the deduction. This requires some record keeping, though. You'll need to keep a receipt of the gift. If you give online, a receipt should be automatically generated for you. Print it out or keep a copy for your records. You'll need it in case you ever get audited. If you use a CPA or other tax preparation service, they'll need to verify your total charitable contributions for the year. Many organizations will send you an end-of-the-year giving statement for your taxes, but don't count on it. Keep your own records throughout the year just in case. Keep in mind that not every organization qualifies for a tax deduction. Be sure you do your homework to avoid any tax time surprises. One easy way to tell is if you see the 501c3 designation at the bottom of the organization's website or in the printed materials. This is a tax status granted by the federal government that allows the organization the ability to receive tax-deductible gifts. If you're not sure, you should contact the organization directly or do a little research online. Credible organizations will always be upfront about their tax status. If an organization you're considering giving to is ambiguous about their status or worse, they outright refuse to discuss it, stay away. Include your children. Create an opportunity to include your children in your giving as a family. They may not understand all the details, but they will remember that you gave to others. Even if you prefer giving electronically, you may want to write actual checks for a season of life just so your kids can watch you physically give money away. Again, watching my parents give every week is a powerful memory for me. They didn't make a big show of it. There were no flashing lights, and Dad never yelled, "Hey kids, look, I'm giving." They just set a stable, consistent example of what giving looks like. Like I said before, I believe more is caught than taught. Your kids are watching your example, so show them what giving looks like. Make sure they know that you are giving, even if you aren't telling them the dollar amounts. And if you're giving electronically, find ways to include them in the process. Anonymous giving. Sometimes I think the best kind of giving is when no one knows it was you. We've talked about how money changes relationships, and this is even true in the world of giving. People get awkward and weird about money, and that discomfort too often gets in the way of someone getting the help they need. They may not accept a huge financial gift from Joe and Susie, but they will probably be over the moon with the gratitude of an anonymous gift that meets a specific need and leaves them scratching their heads. A friend of mine told me about an experience she and her husband had that changed their lives completely. He had heard about a family at work who lost everything in a fire, including their only vehicle. While her husband didn't know the people directly, he knew they didn't make enough to replace everything they had lost. One night over dinner, he told his wife, my friend, about the family and mentioned that he wanted to do something to help them, but without drawing attention to himself. Then he dropped a bombshell. They had been saving up for a new ski boat so the kids could learn to water ski. He suggested instead of getting the boat, they use the money to buy a minivan for this family. He reasoned that if they had a safe place to stay, food to eat, clothes to wear, and a dependable vehicle, then they could get back on their feet. My friend was stunned by her husband's suggestion, but she and their kids thought it was a great idea. They all agreed it was the best thing they could do with that money. The next day, he told his boss, the CEO, what he and his family decided to do for this family. The catch, though, was that he wanted to give the van without anyone ever knowing it was them. His boss took the check, and the company purchased the vehicle for the family. The cool part is the CEO allowed my friends to present the vehicle to the family in need on behalf of the company. She talked about how much it meant to their kids, and that it will leave an impression on them for a lifetime. It doesn't matter whether or not someone knows it was you. Sometimes that's appropriate, and sometimes it's not. Either way, the act of giving changes your relationship with money and with the people around you. Think before you give. If you want the money you give to make a difference, then you need to be thoughtful about where and to whom you give. You want your decision to count. That will require a little extra effort on your part in the beginning. But once you've landed on an organization or a person you feel comfortable supporting, you'll have the confidence each time to give, knowing that your dollars will make a difference. Start with the budget. The first place to start is the charity's budget. It's acceptable and reasonable to want to see a copy of it. All reputable nonprofits make this available to you. Some will do so on their website. Others ask that you call in and request a copy. Either way, if an organization is not willing to give you this information, see that as a red flag and look somewhere else. And don't feel bad about doing this. You should want to know if your money is being used in the way you think is best. If not, it takes the fun and the comfort out of giving because you can't trust how it will be used. Don't give blindly. Make sure you're comfortable with how the organization takes in and uses money. The sad truth is, many nonprofits are terrible at managing their money. People give generously because they think they're helping a worthy organization. But then wasteful, sloppy accounting and business practices eat up almost every penny of every donation. Even if the cause is a good one, if you give to a poorly run nonprofit, your money won't be as effective. Think of your giving dollars like your investing dollars. You wouldn't make a financial investment without digging into the details, right? The same is true when giving to a charity. Dig in and ask questions. Do some research. Search online for tools and resources to learn how well different charities manage their money. There are a few reputable organizations that actually rate different nonprofits the way the Better Business Bureau would rate a business. Seek out these services and take the time to find out everything you can about the nonprofit before you give a donation. Will there be times when you feel the urge to give without doing any research? Sure, but overall, be a diligent and wise giver. You are investing in the future of our world, so do it wisely. Make the best decision. There are a lot of options when deciding on your charitable giving. so many choices that seem intimidating if you don't know where to start. You might choose your church or a charity, or maybe you want to give to an individual who needs help. Sometimes it's to your friends or family. This can be true if they are raising money for something like a mission trip, or if they are in a self-supporting ministry position and you choose to become a financial partner. Whatever the situation or opportunity, remember that you aren't going to personally solve all the world's problems through one gift and one organization. Besides, that's not your job. You can't always say yes. What you do with your money is completely your decision. No one else should make your spending decisions for you, and the same is true for your giving decisions. Just because someone asks doesn't mean you have to say yes, even if it's family. Just a reminder, if a friend or family member needs some financial help, make sure you give that money to them free and clear. Don't loan money to people, especially friends and family. If they need help and you have the money and the inclination to help, that's great. But give it away with no strings attached. Deep and wide. When it comes to your giving, consider the deep and wide approach. You can make a big impact on a few things or a small impact on many things. There is the nickel and dime approach to giving, where you give whenever the checkout cashier asks for money for a charity, usually by adding a dollar to the total or donating the coins you'd get back. While adding a dollar to your grocery bill might be a good idea every now and then, think of ways you can make a bigger impact than just a dollar here and there. It's not bad to give in those instances, but think about the deep and wide mindset. What do you want to do? Whatever you decide, be intentional with that choice and follow through. You will make the most impact when you partner with an organization through a recurring gift and build a relationship with them over time. This is something you'll never get by giving a dollar here and a dollar there. You're also more likely to see or even participate in the direct delivery of the work you are supporting. You can't go deep with every cause or charity, but pick one or two. That will shorten the distance between your dollar and the difference you can make. Winston and I are careful about how we use our charitable dollars. We take it seriously. Unless I feel a huge tug on my heart, I politely decline when the cashier asks for a donation. I used to have a paragraph-long explanation on why I was not giving a dollar. But now, I'm okay with saying no at times because we have researched, asked budgeting questions, and invested a great deal of time, emotion, and money into the places and people we support. This may sound clinical, but it keeps me on track. If I feel led to give to something spontaneously, I listen to that nudge. But more often than not, I don't randomly give. More than just money. What else can you offer when you're giving? Is it just your money? No. You can give much more than just that. Former First Lady Barbara Bush once said, "Some people give time, some money, some their skills and connections, some literally give their life's blood, but everyone has something to give." With this in mind, I suggest you divide your giving into three categories: time, abilities, and money. Giving doesn't always have to result in an exchange of dollars. You have ways to give over and beyond the money you give to others. Volunteer your time and attention. In addition to your money, be generous with your most valuable asset, namely time spent investing in other people's lives. One of my first mentors was like this. She was the most generous person I had ever met, not just with her money, but also her time and attention. She was always willing to talk and spend time with me and answer my questions. She was genuinely interested in my life. She lived her life through the lens of serving and helping others. As a recipient of that love, I wanted to be like her. This early mentor made a huge impact on me that when I was in college, I volunteered with a ministry that paired college-age mentors with high school students in local schools. I spent a lot of time with this great group of girls, and I walked with them for 3 years. Helping them navigate the challenges of high school was a blast. Looking back, I got more out of that time than those high school girls did. When you give, especially when you give your time, it changes you. Generosity shapes you into a more selfless person. And selfless people simply live more joyful, fulfilled, and satisfied lives. When you experience generosity yourself, like I did with my first mentor, you find yourself wanting to pass that blessing along to someone else. Giving is contagious, even when the gift is time. Walk with generous people. Growing up, my parents always told me, "Rachel, you become who you hang out with." When I was in high school, I thought they were just telling me not to hang out with the sketchy teenagers. Now that I've gotten some perspective, I think what they really meant was that I should spend time with people I want to be like. If you want to be generous and kind, spend time with generous and kind people. If you want to be selfish, then hang out with selfish people. Personally, I want to hang out with people who are generous with their time and attention, and I want to avoid people who aren't. When Winston and I first moved back to Nashville, we went out to eat with a couple who seemed like people we would get along with. However, they would not stop talking about themselves the entire time. Winston and I combined didn't say more than 3 words. The experience was completely exhausting, and it didn't take us long before we knew that we weren't going to click with this couple. I felt like I needed a social detox when we got home. You always remember the people in your life who care about you, celebrate with you, and comfort you. Invest your time in people like this. More importantly, strive to be that type of person yourself. A generous life. Dream for a second. Think about all the giving you could do with your money if you were debt-free. How many people could you help if you didn't have a car payment and a student loan payment? That may seem like a long way off, but this is where financial responsibility and behavior combine to create a powerful force of change in your life and in the world around you. So many people think good financial management begins and ends with the balance sheets and investment accounts. Those are important, but it's what good money habits allow you to do that matters the most. And I believe that the most important thing that you can do with your money, and the most fun you can have with money, is to give it. Plus, when you manage money well, get out of debt, and build wealth, you end up with something even more valuable than money. You get time. You get options. You get to choose where to invest your energy and how to live out your passions because you aren't worried about making ends meet. When you combine time, money, options, passion, and the habit of giving, you can literally change the world. Chapter 16. What now? Hearing my phone alarm go off at 5 a.m. is still hard sometimes. At the start of this book, I told you that getting up early is a new habit I have in my life. Some days, it's easier than others to get my feet on the floor. But the weirdest thing happened. After a few weeks of my new morning routine, I started waking up around 5 a.m. even if my alarm wasn't set, like on a Saturday, when I actually wanted to sleep. Sure, I can roll over and go back to sleep, but I still wake up. My body just knows when it's time to get up. That's the great thing about habits. They become automatic. The consistent choices you make with your money from this point on will dictate if you have healthy money habits or destructive ones. I may not always enjoy getting up at 5 a.m., but it has become routine, like budgeting. It's not something I necessarily look forward to, but if I don't do it, things feel out of control. The 7 money habits we discussed throughout this book are like that too. Some habits will be easier than others. Sometimes you won't want to do one. Sometimes it'll seem easier to make a big impulse purchase, swipe a credit card, or not talk to your spouse about money. But the longer you practice these habits, the more automatic they'll become. And when you try to go one way, when your new healthy habits are telling you to go another, you'll know something's off. The exciting thing is, wherever you are in this journey, something is different today than it was when you first picked up this book. You know some things now that you maybe didn't know before. You've had to face some things that maybe you didn't want to face. You had to take an honest look at your life, your goals, and your money, maybe for the first time. You've had to think about what you value, what's really important to you and your family. You had to start prioritizing the things you want to do, realizing that in order to do this, you probably can't do that. The truth is, you've learned some new things, and that information may change everything. In the legal world, they call it unringing the bell. Once the bell sounds, you can't unring it. It's happened, and you can't deny it. You have to deal with it. When it comes to the 7 money habits we've discussed here, you have to decide for yourself if you want to apply these principles and work towards a life you love, or if you're going to dismiss what we've discussed and go back to doing the things the way you've always done them, like impulse buying, credit card swiping, and comparison living. I believe anyone, yes, that means you, can take control of their money and let it work for them to live the life they've always wanted. No, it may not and probably will not happen overnight. And no, you may not be able to have everything you want, especially all at once. But little by little, one decision at a time, you can change the direction of your life. You can be more satisfied, more excited about the life you're living, and you can stop worrying so much about what everyone else seems to have. And ultimately, in time, you can learn how to love your life, not theirs.
Love your life, not theirs. 7 money habits for living the life you want. Written and read by Rachel Cruz. Produced by Joe Lesh of Creative License Incorporated, Nashville, Tennessee. Published by Ramsey Press. Copyright 2016. All rights reserved. Unauthorized duplication is strictly prohibited.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.